sexual revolution that we're seeing is reaching toward its height in this whole thing about gender identification. And the government is jumping on it with both feet, and it will never be able to play itself out in a practical world, because all of human history has always been the recognition of male and female, that men and women are different. And to try to blur that, or to try to take that away, cannot practically work. It's come to the place that you can choose which gender you want to be identified as. In other words, I could say, all right, from now on, y'all call me Mrs. Stewart. I am, from now on, identifying myself as a woman. Well, now, according to the government, that means I can go in women's bathrooms. That means that they can't forbid me from going in there because I am a woman. I've chosen, and you can change your gender anytime you want. You can change it back and forth. Now, here's the thing. I'm just waiting for this to come in sports, all right? Because what you're going to have, if a guy was smart, you know, he would say, I'm a woman, and go join a collegiate softball team, and if he was a halfway good athlete, he could be and excel. Or say he was a good basketball player. I'm a woman, and he gets on a women's basketball team, and, man, he just racks it up. Well, then other guys will get the same idea, and they're going to claim they're women. And then you're going to have the men playing in the women's league. See how crazy it gets? Absolutely crazy. I mean, and it's come to that. You imagine the Olympics now. What are they going to do? Because it's clearly the sports are divided in men and women, right? Track, all these things. All right, you get this guy comes up and says, I'm a woman. I'm going to run in the 100-meter dash with the women. Although he's a man, but he says, I'm a woman. I mean, it's crazy. Crazy. It won't practically work itself out. And you just can't do it. In these schools in California, high schools, this is what's happening. These people are claiming to be the different gender than they are, so they get to use the other gender restroom. And the parents don't want that going on. They don't want a guy going into their daughter's restroom just because he says he's a female. I mean, you know how stupid middle school boys are. Every one of them would say they were female just to get to go in the female locker room, right? And the law would say they'd have to let them go in there. Crazy. Crazy. But we're not here to talk about the craziness of this world. We're here to talk about our Lord and his graciousness and his sovereignty. All right, let me pray as we start. Lord, I do thank you for this night. I thank you we can look into your word. I thank you, Lord, that though our world seems to be spinning out of control, we know that you are in control and that you are actually working out a plan and a purpose much greater than we can even fathom, that will work to your glory and to the advancement of your kingdom and the preparation of a bride for your son, Jesus Christ, in whose name I pray, amen. I want to thank Paul for filling in the last couple of weeks. I know it was a beneficial time for all. And as we get back to our idea of God's sovereignty and our prudence, there are some verses that clearly teach us about our God's sovereignty. One is Psalm 136. In verse 6, which clearly says, whatever the Lord pleases, he does. In heaven, in the earth, in the seas, and in all deeps. That covers it. Whatever the Lord pleases. He does. He does only as he pleases, always as he pleases. Psalm 136, 135, verse 6. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. Where? In heaven, in the earth, in the seas, and in all deeps. That covers everywhere. Everywhere God does as he pleases, only as he pleases, and always as he pleases. Over in Isaiah 46, beginning in verse 9, listen to what God says about himself. Isaiah 46. God says, remember in verse 9 the former things long past. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning, from ancient times things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. That's very clear. My purpose, not might, but will be accomplished. I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Calling a bird of prey from the east, a man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken. Truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. Surely I will do it. God will do what he has planned to do. He will carry forth his purpose. Over in Proverbs 19. In Proverbs 19, verse 21, again, thinking about the sovereignty of God. Many plans are in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord will stand. Now, I just gave you four verses to deal with the sovereignty of God, how he will accomplish his purpose. Whatever he has planned to do, he'll do it. He spoke it. He's going to accomplish it. That we may make our plans, but it's not our plans that make the difference, but it is the counsel of the Lord that stands. Now, any thinking person could take those verses and say, okay, then, God's sovereign. I can plan all I want to, but he's going to accomplish his will, and he's going to fulfill his counsel and his purpose. So, hey, why even bother? I mean, you can see how someone could take these verses and push them to the extreme and just say, well, I don't need to do anything. God's going to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. I mean, he does whatever he pleases, right? In heaven, on the earth, in the seas, and all deeps. So it doesn't matter what I even need to pray, what I need to do anything. Well, we're here at this point in our study to say that it's interesting that none of the biblical writers ever came to that conclusion. Though the psalmist wrote that God does whatever he pleases, in heaven and in the seas and all earth, but David still took measures to hide from King Saul when Saul was seeking to kill him. He could have just said, okay, God, you're going to do whatever you're going to please, and so I won't do anything. I'll just trust you. Now, that's what we call foolishly trusting God. That's not prudence, right? Point number one in your outline, God's sovereignty does not negate our responsibility to act prudently. We saw that with David as he evaded King Saul. We saw that the plot to kill Paul, remember? And he could have just said, well, God's told me I'm going to Rome, so I'm not going to worry about it. He's going to take care of that. No, he didn't come to that conclusion. Now, again, I can see where a person really meaning and wanting to trust God could say, I'm just going to have faith here, and that faith means I'm just going to trust God to take care of this. And you might look at him and think, well, you know, that person's got a lot of faith. But again, faith does not negate prudent action. Unless God specifically tells you to do nothing, then you are to use all legitimate means to bring about what you understand the will of God to be. All right? Unless he tells you directly, do nothing. Stand still and see the salvation of God. Unless he tells you that, then he expects you to be moving, doing all things legitimately to accomplish what you understand his will to be. So think about Paul's trip to Rome. You remember in the storm in the ship, and God said he was going to spare everybody, and the sailors began to try to jump ship, and Paul told the soldier, you better tell them stay here, because if they don't stay, everybody's life will not be spared. Although God told him they all would be, but he recognized the need for those sailors to be there to help bring the ship safely to the island. So he understood God's sovereignty, but he also understood prudent action. Now tonight, we're going to spend our time in the book of Nehemiah. And we're going to look at God's sovereignty and Nehemiah's prudence. You remember, Nehemiah is a part of the second group that came back. Well, I should say the third group that came back from the exile. The first group under Zerubbabel came back, and they worked on building the temple. And then 50 years later, Ezra comes back, and he begins to do some work and try to reform the people because they had gotten away from God again. But then Nehemiah gets word that the walls are in disrepair, and the walls around Jerusalem have never been rebuilt. And so he approaches King Ahasuerus and asks him that he might be able to go and rebuild those walls around Jerusalem. Now, what we're going to look at is we're going to look at the problems that confronted Nehemiah. And then we're going to see his prudence, his wisdom in dealing with these problems. He believed in the sovereignty of God. He understood that God was the one who is in control of all matters. But nevertheless, he felt and knew the need to act prudently. All right? Let's look in the first problem was the walls were broken and the gates were burned. Verses 2 and 3. That Hanana, one of the brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived in the captivity, and about Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So that was the first situation that confronted Nehemiah. He could have said, well, God's in control of history, and he's in control of Jerusalem, and he'll take care of it. But he doesn't do that. What is his response? First, grief. Look in verse 4. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. So he grieved and he prayed. I said, I beseech you, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. And then he goes on to pray, and then he prays again in chapter 2. And it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I have not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. All right? Now, jump down to verse 17. Then I said to them, you see the bad situation we're in Jerusalem? It is desolate, and its gates burn with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. And I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to do good work. So here's what happened. He experienced grief. He turned that grief into an opportunity to pray and ask for God to hear his prayers and to grant that he could go back and work on the walls. And then he goes back and he encourages the people. And he says, come on now, God's with us. We've had favor in the king's eyes. God's going to be with us. Let's get about doing the work. So the people were discouraged, and he sought to encourage them. The next situation, the problem, false accusations of the workers. Verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Gresen the Arab heard it, in other words, these were those who were in opposition to the rebuilding of the walls. They were those Samaritans who had stayed back and who were mixed in their breed, and therefore the Israelites didn't want them to help them in doing the stuff because they felt like they were unclean. And they despised us and said, what is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? So here, they're being accused of rebelling against the king in rebuilding the walls. Because it could be seen that they were seeking to rebuild the walls so that they could resist King Artaxerxes' forces when they came. I mean, you would think, why would someone want to build walls around their city? Well, they'd want to do it for protection. And so you could see that they were doing this in an attempt to prepare themselves so that they can later rebel against King Artaxerxes and their walls will help protect them. Now, we know that's not the truth, but that was what they were being accused of by Sanballat and Tobiah. Well, how did Nehemiah react to this? Look in verse 20. So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. So when they were accused of rebellion, Nehemiah's response was confidence that God would give them success. He believed in God's sovereignty. He believed God would bring about the success that they needed. In chapter 4, we see that those opposing forces again ridicule the workers. Chapter 4, verse 1. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, it would break their stone wall down. Mark Ben Mason over here appreciates that. If somebody told him a wall he was building, man, that thing's so shaky, if a fox jumped on it, it would fall. That would be a great insult, wouldn't it, Mark? And that's exactly what these protesters, these adversaries, Sanballat and Tobiah, are making false ridicule of the workers. Well, what's Nehemiah's response? First, pray. Look in verses 4. Hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their heads. Give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out before you. For they have demoralized the builders. And then, look in verse 6, he takes action. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. And so he prayed, and then they put their prayers, as they say, to shoe leather. They worked. They got back to building the wall. Fourth opposition, the plot to attack the workers. Verse 7. Now when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, and the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on, and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a great disturbance. So here these people are so upset, they're prepared to come and wage war against these Israelites who are rebuilding the walls. And what is Nehemiah's response? First, prayer. Verse 9. But we prayed to our God, and because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. Well, I love that verse. They prayed, and they put up a guard. You see, someone that has the wrong understanding of God's sovereignty would just say, we prayed, and we just left it in God's hands. Nehemiah said, we did pray, but then we also set up the guard. We were there. We were ready. We were prepared. And then the problem of physical exhaustion and even the threat of murder. Verse 10. Thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. I mean, the people were physically exhausted. Our enemies said, we will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. Here again, the enemy is saying, we are going to kill them. They're down. They're exhausted. We're going to come and kill them. Well, what's the prudent response that Nehemiah gives? He positions the people by families with their weapons. Verse 13. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall and exposed places. And I stationed people in families with their swords, spears, and bows. See the wisdom in that? He put them with their families, because you're going to fight to protect your family more than you'll fight to protect anybody else, right? I mean, you know, I'll try to fight for Reggie's family. But, you know, if my family's there, buddy, I'm going to kick it up a notch, right? So he puts them there with their families in those places with swords, with spears, and bows. So he sets up a guard, and he gives them weapons. And when I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. And when our enemy heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. And from that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, and bows and breastplates. And the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. And those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand, doing the work, and the other holding a weapon. Boy, I love that. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded to his side, and he built while the trumpeter stood near me to blow the warning. Don't you love it? These guys are working. They're trusting God, but they got the sidearm with them. Huh? If ever was a passage to speak to carrying a weapon, that's it, buddy. It doesn't show a lack of trust in God. It's just prudence. They had the weapon in one hand, working with the other. The others who had to use both hands had this weapon by the side. They were trusting God, but they were being prudent. And I said to the nobles, verse 19, officials and rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we're separated on the wall far from one another. And whatever place you hear the sound of a trumpet, rally us there. Our God will fight for us. See that? We're spread out. So if you hear the trumpet being blown over here, you run over here. This is where the attack is. But who's fighting for them? God. They were not putting their confidence in themselves, but nevertheless, they were acting prudently to defend themselves. You see, trusting God doesn't negate our responsibility to be prudent, to be wise, to take all legitimate measures to accomplish what we believe the work of the Lord to be. And then there was the plot. Well, first, let's see, the encouragement and encouragement of the people, verse 20. And that's where he says, God will fight for us. He's encouraging them. Fight, but God's fighting for you. And then there is the plot to assassinate Nehemiah in chapter 6. Now, when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors in the gates, then Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, come up and meet together at Shearim in the plain of Ona. But they were planning to harm me. All right, so they plan and want to assassinate him. But what's his response? He refuses to go. So I sent messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? He saw what was going on. He didn't just say, well, I'll go down there, God will protect me. No, he said, I'm not going. You're not going to get me down there. I'm working. I don't need to stop the work. And then, look at the slander against Nehemiah in verses 5 through 7. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Gesmu says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king according to these reports. You've also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you. A king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king Ahasuerus, or Artaxerxes, according to these reports. So come now, let us take counsel together. Still trying to get him down there so they can kill him. So they lie about him. They're saying that you are wanting to be king, and you've got people out there, prophets, saying that you're to be the king. All right, what's his response? First, he denies it. Then I sent a message to him saying, such things as you are saying have not been done, but you are inventing them in your own mind. That's a polite way to say you're lying, isn't it? You're inventing these things in your own mind. And then look, he prays. For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. He prays. See how much he prays? Man, he is praying almost every one of these things he's praying in him. And then there was the plot to discredit Nehemiah. Again, these people don't want to give up. Look in verse 10. When I heard the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaliah, son of Mehishtabel, who was confined at home, he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the door to the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night." So he wants to get Nehemiah in this closed-up space so he can kill him. But I said, "Should a man like me flee? And could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Then I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly in sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. Here's a prayer. "Remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these works of theirs, and also Noadiah the prophetess, and the rest of the prophets who were trying to frighten me." So here, he prays, he refuses to go, he trusts the Lord. Next problem, neglect of the temple tithes and offerings. All right, this is over in chapter 13. I also discovered that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, so that the Levites and the singers who performed the service had gone away each to his own field. Now, they were to bring their tithes to pay the Levites who were responsible for the administration of the temple and upkeep of the temple. Remember? And the priest? So they were to bring their tithes to, so these Levites could fulfill their responsibilities. That's where we get the same idea about you giving to support me and the other staff. That's where this concept comes from, as other places in Scripture. But they were not doing this, and so the Levites had to go back to farming to try to raise support. Verse 11, "So I reprimanded the officials and said, 'Why is the house of God forsaken?' Then I gathered them together and restored them to their post. All Judah then brought the tithe of the grain, the wine, and oil into the storehouse. And in charge of the storehouse, I appointed Shelemiah the priest, Sadok the scribe, Pedaiah of the Levites, and in addition to them was Hanan the son of Zachar, the son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable, and it was their task to distribute to their kinsmen. Remember me for this, O my God. Do not blot out my loyal deeds, which I have performed for the house of my God and its services." So what does he do? They are neglecting the tithes and offerings. He rebukes the people. He says, "You need to not be doing this. You need to be bringing them in." And then he stations the Levites at their post to make sure the people are bringing it in, that it's rightly being accounted for. And then he prays. Again, pray. Number 10, the violation of the Sabbath by business practices. Verse 15, "In those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine and grapes and figs and all kinds of loads, and they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day they sold food." So what does he do? He rebukes them. "Also, men of Tyre were living there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What is this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought us and on this city all this trouble? Yet you are adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath.'" It came about that just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded the doors should be shut and that they should not open them until after the Sabbath. Then I stationed some of my servants at the gates so that no load would enter at the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the traders and merchants, every kind of merchant, spent the night outside Jerusalem, thinking they were going to get in. Then I warned them and said to them, "Why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you." From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness. So what does he do? When the Sabbath is being violated, he rebukes them. He said, this is wrong. You shouldn't be doing this. You're doing the very thing that caused God to send us into exile. We won't have any more of it. In fact, he closed the gate to Jerusalem so they couldn't come in to do trading and merchandise, and even stationed a guard at the gate. And when the merchants were hanging around outside the gate, he said, y'all get lost. I'm not going to have this. You get away from here. They were just trying to tempt people to come out and do business. He said, no, you get away from here. I'll drive you away by force. And then what does he do? He prays. He prays. And then he confronts mixed marriages in verses 23 and 24. In those days I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod and Ammon and Moab. And as for their children, half spoke the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of their own people. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons nor take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Did not King Solomon of Israel sin against these things, regarding these things? Yet among the many nations, there was no king like him. And he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused him to sin. Do we then hear about you that you've committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? Even one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, even the priests were doing this, was a son-in-law of Sanballat and Horonite, so I drove them away from me. I mean, they had so intermarried that they were marrying the daughters of these two malcontents, Sanballat, and he was part of the family. So he rebukes them, he removes the guilty priest, and then he prays. Verse 29, Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I purified them from everything foreign and appointed duties for the priest and the Levites, each in his task. And I arranged for the supply of wood at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. Boy, Nehemiah had his problems, didn't he? Woo! But he believed in God's sovereignty, and he also believed in prudence, wise action. He acted and he prayed. He acted and he prayed. He acted and he prayed over and over again. That's a lesson for us. The sovereignty of God should encourage prayer, as we said. Because if he's not sovereign, why pray? But since he is sovereign, we do pray. All right, Paul, I'm going to ask you now to come up.